It's Central Time. I'm Rob Farah. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. First, end-of-life decision-making can be difficult and emotionally challenging, whether we're making our own decisions or making them for or along with a loved one. One big question, how aggressive should medical care be in the last days or weeks of life? Our next guest has followed that issue, including a new study that finds that aggressive medical care is fairly common for people in the latest stages of terminal cancer. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you had this experience recently in your own family, something you'd be comfortable sharing about? Did the person get the care they wanted and not get the care that they didn't want? What questions do you have about end-of-life care and these difficult conversations with family members and healthcare providers? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Paula Spann is a journalist who writes columns for the New York Times called The New Old Age and Generation Grandparent. She's the author of the book When the Time Comes, Families with Aging Parents Share Their Struggles and Solutions, and she teaches in the Columbia University Graduate School of Journalism. Her recent piece for the Times is called Aggressive Medical Care Remains Common at Life's End. Paula, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Happy to be with you, Rob.
You've been talking about these issues for a long time. I want to start with your piece on this more recent study focusing on cancer patients and the treatment they get. What were researchers looking at and what did they find?
Well, just as background, people have been working for years to try to reduce aggressive care at the end of life. It's not what patients say they want. They don't want to die in hospitals. They don't want to be kept alive by machines. In general, they want a peaceful passage. And so for the Medicare approved coverage of hospice care 40 years ago, 1983. So I was interested to see that in this new study in the Journal of the American Medical Association, these researchers at Case Western Reserve School of Medicine found that the amount of aggressive care was still so high. These were patients who were in the last 30 days of their lives, and they had metastatic cancer. That means cancer that has spread. So these were people who were not going to recover. And yet, 58% of them who were older people living in the community, these were all Medicare beneficiaries, 58% of them got aggressive care in the end of life. And if they were nursing home residents, it was 64%. And aggressive care in this case means things like, were they being treated for their cancer? Were they getting surgery or radiation or chemotherapy? Were they being sent to the emergency room? Were they being sent to the ICU? Were they enrolled in hospice in time for hospice to really support them? So it's discouraging that after all these years, this is still the case for this population, which was so clearly at the brink of death.
And to put some names and faces on this, you start your piece looking at an example. You talked to someone named Jennifer O'Brien about a story from her family and her father. Can you tell us what she shared with you?
Sure. So her father, Jennifer O'Brien, lives in Little Rock, Arkansas. Her father, who was 84, was a very independent guy, lived alone in rural New Mexico, said he didn't need any help. But a neighbor found him on the floor with a broken hip and called an ambulance. So Mr. O'Brien was already in very poor health. He had heart failure. He was a smoker, so he had advanced lung disease. He needed a walker for a spinal injury. He was so short of breath that he had to use a thing called a BiPAP, which is a kind of a portable ventilator with a tight mask over your face. And he had to wear it all the time, except when he was eating. So when he was in the hospital and Jennifer became involved in his care, they were just, the surgeons wanted to repair his hip. And that's a big repair. That's a big operation to repair a hip. And this was a person who was very close to dying, but he was mentally competent to make his own decisions. So when his daughter said to him on the phone with a palliative care nurse practitioner, "Dad, your heart and your lungs are just done," he decided no, he did not want to undergo this surgery. The anesthesia is dangerous to older people. The inability to move around is dangerous to old people. Hospitals themselves are often dangerous to old people. He decided against having the repair. The doctors were upset, called Jennifer thinking, well, you can talk him into it. She said she declined to do that. And she called a hospice and he died in a few days. And she went to see him and she was with him at the end. But he declined to undergo aggressive care. But he was able to make his own decisions. Oftentimes it's families that are making these decisions for people. And that can be where a lot of the problem arises.
Talking to Paula Spann with the New York Times, she wrote a recent piece on aggressive end-of-life care. Sometimes if it's not what the patient wants, what their family wants, or if it's the best call for a patient, you can join in at 800-642-1234. Pretty much every family is going to go through a moment like this at some point. Maybe you have an experience to share with us from your own family. If you're looking at this from the healthcare provider perspective, love to hear what you've seen as well. 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Serena is with us in Menominee. Serena, hello.
Hi.
What did you want to share with us, Serena?
So I went through, I guess you would say, a hospice care with my aunt. So previously, she had gone through so many doctors. She had so much wrong with her. She had lupus, osteoporosis, osteoarthritis, rheumatoid arthritis. You pretty much name it, she had it. And so what had happened is one toe had been slammed against, this is where it all started, sorry. And one toe had been slammed up against something and it ended up dying. So they had to remove the toe. And then that caused an infection in her leg. She had to have one leg removed. And then the other toe, the big toe on the other leg died. It just, there was no rhyme or reason for it. It just happened. And then they found out that her neuropathy had gotten so bad that there was no, like, massive blood flow to her leg. So she had to have the other leg removed. And after that, like, it went downhill pretty quickly. And she had decided on her own to go into hospice care. And I asked her probably about a week after she had signed the papers that I'm like, why are you doing this? What is wrong? You know, what can I help with? She's like, I'm just sick of being in pain. And to me, that was an acceptable answer because she's my aunt. I've known her all my life. You know, I took care of her for the last 5 years, taking her to and from every single doctor's appointment, from here to Timbuktu. And to me, that was an acceptable answer. And she died a month to the day after signing the hospice paper.
Serena, thanks for sharing your story. Paula, every story is unique, but I think a lot of common themes in there, how people make these difficult decisions. Can you talk a little bit about what we heard from Serena there?
Yeah. Serena, I'm sorry for your loss. Mm-hmm. You were spent 5 years as a family caregiver. That's a stressful role. But I agree with you that it's a perfectly acceptable answer if a person of any age, but especially an older person who may never recover to be the person they used to be after multiple medical interventions. I think it's acceptable for that person to say, I've had enough, I'm sick of pain, I want a comfortable ending, but I don't want to prolong my life. But I will point out that when we talk about why is there so much aggressive care at the end of life, there's plenty of blame to go around. So you will hear family members often say, these doctors just won't have a frank conversation. We don't even know that someone's dying. They don't know exactly how to say it. They keep suggesting more and more procedures and operations and drugs, and there's always something else to try. And on the other hand, you will hear healthcare professionals say, no, it's the families. The families don't want to let go. The families are saying, do everything possible. We can't let them die. And I think what we all have to remember, regardless of what our role is in this process, is that immortality is not one of our options. We all have to face death, and we should have choices about how to do that. But the idea that that the system has to keep you alive at all costs, puts you on this kind of medical conveyor belt that your aunt was on, where there's you do this and then you do that and then this problem arises, so then you have to fix that. And I think people have the right to say, I've had enough now, let's stop.
Serena, thanks again for being willing to share that with us. We'll go to Jim now in Menominee Falls. Jim, hi.
Hi. I wanted to share the end of life of my father, which was about a decade ago. He was a family physician and, you know, took care of many patients from birth to death. He really did everything. And when it came time, he was suffering from prostate cancer and a hip replacement and renal failure. And so he knew he was towards the end of life. And he had a shunt put in for dialysis. And I was with him when he went in for the procedure, and he made it very clear to them that this is a DNR, you know, situation. He did not want to be resuscitated. And when they put it in, there was a problem, and his heart stopped. And they brought him back, put him on a ventilator, and they had him on a feeding tube, and they couldn't, you know, because they told me that it was because it was during a surgical procedure, they couldn't, you know, they couldn't do the DNR because we didn't really get a clear answer to that. And so there were long decisions about, you know, how do we do this? Do we, you know, we were the ones that had to, you know, take away the feeding tube, take away the breathing tube. And there was, you know, several days there where, you know, you could tell that the patient was in agony, even though he was in a coma. And it was, you know, it's a horrible situation for anybody, but for a physician who knew everyone, and they still did those things, even though he expressed DNR. You know, that was very troubling.
Jim, I'm sorry you went through that, and thanks for sharing that. Paula, an express decision made. No, there's a do not resuscitate order, but in the heat of surgery, that order is ignored. Is that common?
Oftentimes, if there's a surgical procedure, they do say you have to revoke your DNR while you're in surgery, and then you can restore it afterwards. It is troubling, Jim, you're right, especially for someone who had foreseen this possibility and thought he had taken a precaution against it. But I would just mention to people who are in the crunch with family members who are near death, but there are all these procedures and operations being proposed, that the magic words in a hospital are, there's two, three. One is palliative care. Palliative care doctors are the ones that help people be comfortable and manage symptoms, but they are not necessarily dealing with curable diseases. And the other is hospice, which is the Medicare-funded program for people at the end of life. And it allows most people in hospice to die at home, which is where they want to be and not in a hospital. When you say palliative care, I want a palliative care consultation, or when you say we want to call hospice, that's kind of a signal to the staff at a medical institution that you understand that death is near and that you're trying to keep this person comfortable. You're trying to give this person a good death, the so-called good death, but you're not expecting miracles, and that you know that immortality is not on the table. So I would just pass this along to listeners to know palliative care and hospice. But Jim, it's infuriating, and I'm just so sorry he had to suffer.
Jim, thanks again for sharing that. We are talking about end-of-life care, why it's sometimes more aggressive than patients and their families want. Journalist and author Paula Spann is with us from the New York Times, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. Is this ringing a bell? Is this something you've been through in your own life, maybe recently with a loved one? If you are a healthcare provider, what do you want patients to know? Do you work in hospice or palliative care? I'd love to hear your perspective as well. Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our talk with Paula Spann, journalist and columnist of the New York Times. We're talking about a recent piece she wrote called Aggressive Medical Care Remains Common at Life's End. Before we go back to our callers at 800-642-1234, Paula, you write in your piece that there's one kind of weird thing in the system where people receiving Medicare who are in hospice care sometimes have trouble getting treatment that they can actually use that would be palliative care because of Medicare guidelines. Can you talk us through that?
Yeah, it's a little complicated, but basically, when you enter hospice care, you give up curative care. So you can still get all kinds of treatments if they help keep you comfortable, but you can't get things like curative surgery for cancer. And so this tends to make certain groups of people reluctant to enroll in hospice in time. And hospice, let me explain, really, people should be in hospice care for weeks and months. But the length of stay is very short. People wait till the very last minute. But hospice can do great things for families, give great support, and people shouldn't wait until someone's a week from dying. In this case, there's something called concurrent care. And where you see this is with people who are in kidney failure and they're on dialysis. So if you stop dialysis and you're in kidney failure, you will die in a week to 2 weeks. But the Veterans Affairs healthcare system is more liberal in its criteria than regular hospice. And so through the VA, the people in kidney failure can continue to get what's called palliative dialysis. It controls your symptoms, it helps you feel better, but you don't have to go 3 times a week for 4 hours. You can do it less often, you can do it for less time. And so those people, I talked about a study done in the VA. When you require people to give up dialysis in order to enter regular Medicare hospice, they die within a week or two. But when you allow them to have concurrent care through the VA, they live for another, let's say, 40 days. I think it was 43. So that gives people time to see family, to see friends, to say goodbye, to, maybe enjoy one more spring or go to a granddaughter's wedding. But more to the point, if people have to give up things that they have come to rely on that make them feel better in order to enter hospice care, sometimes they just don't. So their Medicare is pilot testing this in several locations, and we may see change on that in the next year or two.
Let's go back to our callers. Rana is with us in Rice Lake. Rana, what did you want to share with us?
Hi, good afternoon, and thank you to your guest. I've cared for both my parents towards their end, and they both had incredibly different end-of-life experiences. My dad moved in with us. We live in an area that has relatively stable health care. We're still rural, but we have people on staff and a good, stable work environment. So when my dad needed hospice, it was available. We had people coming. His end of life was calm and smooth and was what I would have wanted for him. My mom, however, had lived in a much more rural community, had one hospice staff member who was not even from that area, who came from St. Croix Falls to do the hospice work there. That's about a 4.5 hour trip. Hospice and palliative care were so, there was so, the staffing was so short, the communication was so terrible. Some of the staffing came up from Mississippi to work in this care facility. Because there wasn't enough. My mom was the one in the nursing home yelling, "Help, help," for 4 months while she died a horrible death. Her sister, who is the POA, couldn't come to terms with mom needing to go on hospice, so she would just allowed mom to suffer terribly, and it was one of the worst experiences I've ever had in my life. I was with my parents both until the end, of course. That's where I needed to be. But I will be forever questioning that particular care facility's abilities to really care for people in their end of life.
Well, Rana, I'm so sorry about that experience, but it raises a big question, Paula. Even if we do agree that we want more people to have more hospice access, do we have the staffing? Do we have the facilities to accommodate that?
Well, hospice has really grown so that the most recent statistics are that now about half of the Medicare recipients who die in most recent year died in hospice care. So it's huge growth. And most places do have at least one, but you want a choice really of hospices. But what Rana talks about is a problem with all kinds of health care, which is rural areas have trouble getting and keeping personnel. And the distances are so long that it could become economically infeasible. So it is a big problem, not related only to hospice and palliative care, but all kinds of care. I've just recently written about people unrelated to this topic, people who put off having necessary procedures like colonoscopies or cataract surgery because they don't have anyone to pick them up and take them home. And that, you know, when people, 1,000 people wrote in with comments, and one of the refrains was, think about what happens if you're the nearest healthcare, the nearest ambulatory surgical center is a 2-hour drive. It's just, it's a big problem that goes beyond end of life. But Rana, it's a very sad story. I will say that in my own family, we have managed, both my parents and my sister, I have accompanied to their deaths. And this is in New Jersey in each case, and where there's plenty of hospices and plenty of healthcare providers. But you do sometimes have to be the one who stands up and says, you know, I am her surrogate decision maker, and I say, we've had enough. I know what her wishes are. She would not want to live like this. No, we will not consent to this proposed treatment. No, we are calling hospice. And I'm just sorry, Rana, that you were not the person who had that legal authority for your mother, because it sounds like you knew what to do and it couldn't happen. It's a terrible situation.
Rana, thanks again for calling. And Paula, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Paula Spann. She writes the New Old Age and Generation Grandparent columns for the New York Times. We talked with her about a recent piece she wrote headlined Aggressive Medical Care Remains Common at Life's End. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. First, we're in the third week of spring, and migratory birds are coming back to Wisconsin. Many birds, like red-winged blackbirds and waterfowl, are already back. There are many more to expect as it gets warmer in the next few months. We're talking about spring birding in Wisconsin, and you could join in at 800-642-1234. What birds have you been spotting? Which ones are you looking forward to? What are your favorite birds to see this time of year? If our favorite place to go, whether it's your backyard, a state park, you name it, call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Stanley Temple is a professor emeritus of forest and wildlife ecology and environmental studies at UW-Madison, and he's a bird expert. Stan, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Rob.
I'm excited, Stan, and I'll tell you why. Following the advice of some other guests over the last year, I'm at the bus stop. I don't pull out my phone. I stand there and I look around for birds. And that's been really boring because all I see is house sparrows, if I'm lucky, a crow or maybe a gull flying up high. My viewing is about to expand a lot, right?
You're right. April and May are the time for spring migrants to arrive.
Excellent. And which ones are already here that we might already be getting an eye on here in Wisconsin?
Well, I think you mentioned a couple of red-winged blackbirds come back in February. Actually, so do our sandhill cranes. And sandhill cranes are now pretty ubiquitous around the state and very noisy as they're establishing their territories. So most people are aware that they've returned. Killdeers are back. A lot of the earliest arriving birds actually do come back in late February.
Now, what divides the birds that are coming back to Wisconsin to stay and nest over the summer versus the ones that, you know, Wisconsin's just sort of flyover, stopover country for them?
Well, it all depends, of course, where they're targeting for breeding. And for Wisconsin, we actually do have a lot of the birds that we see during April and May are going to settle somewhere in the state to breed. But there are others that are headed much further north, that are headed up to the boreal forests of Canada or even to the high Arctic. So the birds that are headed for the boreal forest, some of the familiar birds might be things like white-throated sparrows that often turn up at bird feeders, broad-winged hawks, and quite a few warblers. And for the birds that are headed to the Arctic, tundra swans have already started coming through, lots of waterfowl species, and most of the shorebirds that pass through Wisconsin are actually headed for the Arctic.
I want to give a listen to some birds that we can watch out for. We've got some bird calls here. First, the house wren. All right, I've heard that sound. Stan, I don't know if I could pick a house wren out of a lineup, but tell us about the house wren.
Well, house wrens are fairly familiar to people because they often nest in the nest boxes that we put out in our yard. And they are just about to arrive. Mid-April is a good time to see them. And they're coming to us mostly from southeast, from wintering in the southeast U.S. And they said they're very familiar because for most of us, if you put out a box in your yard, wrens are almost certain to find it. So they're a very familiar bird.
And now we'll give a listen to the eastern phoebe. Okay, I get a familiar sound. Tell us about the Easter phoebe, Stan.
Yeah, eastern phoebes are also fairly familiar because they often nest under the eaves of our house if we've got some decent habitat around our house. So again, they're familiar birds, and they've already arrived. They came in early April, and sort of like the house wrens, they've spent the winter in southeastern U.S. and are just arriving now.
Talking to Stan Temple from UW-Madison. It is spring. It is bird migration season. We're figuring out what to watch out for this time of year and in the month or so to come. You could join in at 800-642-1234 to report your sightings or what you're looking forward to. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller. Bruce is with us in Kenosha County. Bruce, hi.
Hi. I'm calling from Kenosha County. I live on a lake down here. And the last few years, during their migration, the pelicans stop in. We have about 100 pelicans in this flock that's been hanging out at our lake for a couple of days.
Have they shown up yet this year, Bruce?
Yeah, we've been watching for the last couple of days. I haven't seen them feeding this year, but that's fun to watch them feed.
Fantastic. That's an amazing bird to see, especially with quantities of them, Bruce, right?
Yeah, it's like 100 of them, and they come sailing in all in formation, right? And then they just kind of cruise around the lake in a big group, and they rejoin each other and split up, and it's fun to watch.
Bruce, thanks a lot for the call. I don't know if people think of Wisconsin, Stan, as a pelican state. I have seen them, not in the numbers that Bruce has, though.
Well, they're a fairly recent addition to the state. They traditionally, historically, bred further west, but certainly over the last 20 or 30 years, they've been moving east and are now, well, as Bruce said, fairly common in some places around Wisconsin. They've just arrived again from spending the winter down in the southeast U.S., and at least one explanation for the increase in numbers and their spread eastward has been the expansion of fish farming in the southeast U.S., which gives them an abundant supply of food over the winter.
Bruce, thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Stan, is it common for birds to change their migration pattern to over time start to show up in places like Wisconsin where maybe they didn't used to?
Well, it does happen. And of course, we're seeing some fairly rapid changes in the migration behavior of quite a few birds in response to climate change. So the schedules on which many of the short distance migrants, the birds that are basically spending the winter somewhere in the US, those short distance migrants are arriving much earlier than they did in the past as our winters get shorter and spring comes earlier. So people have probably noticed things like robins, for example, are arriving very early in the year, sometimes almost 2 to 3 weeks earlier than they did in the past.
Stan, I know a big issue for various migratory birds over the years has been habitat preservation, availability of the kinds of stopovers that birds need. Have we done a decent job in more recent decades of making sure that our key migratory birds have what they need?
Well, in the past, we did a very strategic job of providing stopover places for migrant waterfowl, primarily through the National Wildlife Refuge System. And it's more recently that we started to worry about stopover habitat for some of the other migratory birds. So yes, indeed, it is important. The difficulty, though, for many of our migratory birds is it's difficult to predict when and where they're going to have to settle during migration. That is often determined by the immediate weather conditions. So the strategy for providing habitat, stopover habitat for most migrant birds is to have a good diversity of habitats across the landscape rather than having specific places on the map.
Let's go back to our callers. Carrie is with us in Horicon Marsh. Carrie, are you at the marsh right now?
I'm in Horicon, yes.
What did you want to tell us about?
I joined the conversation a little late, but I just wanted to talk about the birds we see in the watery fields right by our house. There were hundreds of swans this year, many types of ducks, pelicans, of course. But this year I saw something I hadn't seen before, and I don't know if this is something that's been around the last couple of years and I just didn't notice. It's called the white-fronted goose.
The white-fronted goose. Carrie, thanks for that, Stan. Is that somebody we usually see, Stan?
Well, white-fronted geese do turn up in migration in Wisconsin, but not that common, not nearly as common, for example, as Canada geese. But yeah, they do turn up occasionally. And like many of the birds that you just talked about, the tundra swans and many of the waterfowl species that you're seeing there, are probably heading for breeding areas much further north of Wisconsin. So the tundra swans, of course, their name kind of gives it away. They're headed for the Arctic tundra.
Carrie, thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Carrie mentioned Horicon and the Horicon Marsh there. Stan, how important is that marsh and other wetlands in Wisconsin for our birds, especially the migratory ones?
Well, Horicon, of course, is a state and federal wildlife refuge, and it was specifically created to provide habitat for water birds. And Horicon, of course, not only provides good stopover habitat for many species, but it also, of course, is breeding habitat for many. So as a very large, extensive, well-managed wetland, Horicon is a very important wetland. In fact, is already designated as a wetland of international importance.
We're talking about spring bird watching with Stan Temple, Professor Emeritus of Forest and Wildlife Ecology and Environmental Studies at UW-Madison. You can join in at 800-642-1234. We want to hear about your springtime bird sightings. What have you seen in your neck of the woods so far? Where do you go? Do you go hiking to see birds in particular environments? What questions do you have for our guest? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. Check. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation about migratory birds and spring birdwatching season. Stan Temple is with us, Professor Emeritus of Forest and Wildlife Ecology and Environmental Studies at UW-Madison. You could join in at 800-642-1234. What birds are showing up in your yard, your neighborhood? Who are you looking forward to? What questions do you have for our guest about migratory birds, their habitats, their habits here in Wisconsin? The number is 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Want to get back to some of our bird calls? Here's a listen to another one. Okay, Stan, I'm not great at identifying bird calls, but even I know that one's the whippoorwill. Can you talk about the whippoorwill?
Yeah, whippoorwill is a very distinctive call and, of course, associated with more rural wooded parts of Wisconsin. They'll be arriving in late April, And they have come a fair ways. They've come from the southern U.S. and as far away as Central America. And they are very consistent about their arrival dates. So they are pretty precise about arriving in that last week in April.
Are there other birds that have that kind of timing precision?
Well, most of the long distance migrants, the ones that are spending the winter in Central America and South America, are much more precise from year to year about the timing of their migration, because they are using photo period, they're using day length as their key sort of migration clock. And that doesn't change, of course, from year to year, and they can basically time their migrations very precisely. The short distance migrants, some of the birds that we've already been talking about, of course, that winter in the US, experience North American temperature. So they often are varying quite a bit from year to year based on whether it's an early warm spring or a late cold spring.
We heard from Willem in Colfax who wanted to ask about merlins. Are they rare, he asks, or are they still around?
Ah, merlins, a favorite species of mine. I did my master's thesis studying merlins. Merlins have increased phenomenally since the pesticide era, and have greatly expanded their range into mostly the northern half of Wisconsin. But they are now becoming, you know, not an uncommon bird across the upper Midwest. And some of the birds have actually wintered with us, especially in urban areas where they are very fond of dining on house sparrows and some of the other common urban birds.
The pesticide story, when I think of the DDT era, I think mostly of bald eagles in particular. They have clearly made a comeback since that era. What other birds were hit hard then that maybe have done better since we banned DDT?
Well, we've got a bunch of them in Wisconsin. Peregrine falcons, of course, are back and nesting in quite a few places, including just yesterday, the pair that nests here in Madison laid their first egg of the year. Ospreys have increased tremendously and, again, are now nesting within sight of the Capitol. But probably for many people, the bird that is a surprising backyard bird in most urban areas of Wisconsin is the Cooper's hawk, that was really decimated by pesticides and has come back strong and found backyard bird feeders to be a very easy pickings for meals on small birds.
And speaking of backyard feeders, if we want to feed birds, or I guess the birds that eat the birds that feed on the feeder, what kind of things do you see as most helpful for birds that might need that little assist if their habitat isn't all it could be?
Well, if we focus on the migrants that are just starting to arrive, there are things you can do. We've mentioned birds like house wrens. So clean out the nest boxes and make sure they're ready for occupancy. Keeping your bird feeders going, and especially for some of the specialists like Baltimore Orioles and ruby-throated hummingbirds, put out the oriole feeders and hummingbird feeders in time. For almost all of our migrants, keep your bird bath full, because most of the birds that are migrating overnight come down, land in the morning, they're exhausted, they're dehydrated, and are anxious to find something to drink. And of course, this time of year, those birds are tired when they land, and they are easy victims for cats. So perhaps especially this time of year, keep your cat indoors. There are things that you can do in your community. Wisconsin has a wonderful program called Bird City Wisconsin that encourages communities to do things that provide habitat and other conditions that help birds. And of course, we all are probably aware that many birds meet their end during migration by running into lighted structures like buildings. So in your community, you can encourage owners of tall buildings to shut their lights off at night.
Talking to Stanley Temple, Professor Emeritus of Forest and Wildlife Ecology and Environmental Studies at UW-Madison, a bird expert, talking about spring migration season, the exciting birds showing up in Wisconsin now and in the weeks to come. Still time for you to join in with your sightings, your questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. I want to give a listen to one more audio clip here. We've got the gray catbird. Okay, that's kind of a fun little sound. Tell us about the gray catbird.
Well, they are a fairly long distance migrant, and they're going to be arriving in late April with that very distinctive sort of mewing call. And they've come from as far away as Central America, where they spend the winter. So like many of the long distance migrants, they tend to be fairly precise about the time when they migrate and arrive in Wisconsin.
Now, Stan, over the years, we've talked about threats to bird species. You've done work on the passenger pigeon, for example, no longer with us. Where do you look with concern now at our modern bird species? What are some of your greatest areas of worry?
Well, that gets pretty diverse because there are so many real threats to birds these days. The principal one, of course, is habitat. The fact that human beings are destroying and altering the habitat that bird species need. We know that a disturbing proportion of the birds of the world, as well as birds in the state of Wisconsin, are suffering declines because of habitat loss. In many cases, it's things that are often not happening necessarily in Wisconsin, but things that can be affecting the birds while they're on migration or on their wintering grounds. We know that there are other things that we have done a pretty good job of taking care of. We mentioned earlier the pesticide era, when many of the top predatory birds really suffered as a result of contamination of their food chain. And that's a problem that we have more or less solved. And it's not as much of a threat to birds as it used to be. So the main focus really now is this sort of race against time to protect and manage habitat that will accommodate these birds, both on the wintering grounds while they're migrating and on the breeding ground.
On a happier note, you mentioned earlier sandhill cranes. I've already seen some this season. You know, my wife grew up in Wisconsin and talked about, you know, that was something you didn't see. And now we see them. That seems like a pretty good success story. Stan, do you think that example might be an inspiration for other success stories for other species?
Well, for some species, it can be. The sandhill crane is an example of a species that benefited from the very first federal protection for wildlife, and that was the Migratory Bird Treaty of 1918, just celebrated the centenary. It protected birds from direct killing, and sandhill cranes across the Midwest became rare and just about disappeared from the upper Midwest for the fairly simple reason that we were killing them. And for sandhill cranes, they have a very low reproductive rate, so it took them a long time to recover. But by the 1970s and 1980s, the population reached its stride and has been increasing rapidly ever since. So that Wisconsin is pretty well saturated with sandhill cranes now, and the additional birds that we're producing in Wisconsin are spreading out into surrounding Midwestern states. So we're actually sort of a source for birds recovering in other areas.
And in just our last few minutes, Stan, you've seen a lot of birds. You've studied a lot of birds. Is there something that you are excited when you get that rare glimpse here in Wisconsin?
Well, birds of prey are always my my favorite. So I'm always very excited to see birds of prey doing their thing, being predators and showing off their mastery of the air and their wonderful ability to do things in the air that we often think are not really possible. Peregrine falcons perhaps come to mind for being the fastest birds on wing and just dramatic birds to watch. And fortunately now in Wisconsin, there are literally dozens of places where peregrine falcons are nesting, where one can easily watch them Many of the nest sites have nest cameras on them, so that if you want to tune in online, you can sort of eavesdrop on what the birds are doing.
Stan, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, you're welcome, Rob.
That's Stan Temple, Professor Emeritus of Forest and Wildlife Ecology at UW-Madison. He joined us for a look at spring bird watching in Wisconsin. You can keep sharing your sightings on the Ideas Network Facebook page. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Now, in his first inaugural address in 1981, Republican President Ronald Reagan made clear his support for the free market.
In this present crisis, government is not the solution to our problem. Government is the problem.
And Democratic President Bill Clinton would go on to echo Reagan in his 1996 State of the Union address.
The era of big government is over.
Our next guest points toward both of those statements as examples of an economic idea that became dominant over time in the United States, market fundamentalism. That's the idea loosely that free markets can meet all of our needs, economic and otherwise, and that government regulation and intervention inevitably distorts the free market in negative ways. For many Republicans and Democrats, this theory has become very influential. But our next guest says that free market fundamentalism is a myth built over generations by American business leaders in a long-running campaign of public relations and outreach that targeted government policymakers, the education system, popular culture, and more. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What thoughts do you have? What questions do you have about the philosophy of an unregulated free market? Do you see a need for some government intervention, or is government the problem? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Naomi Oreskes is professor of science history at Harvard University. She's the co-author, along with Eric Conway, of Merchants of Doubt, How a Handful of Scientists Obscured the Truth on Issues from Tobacco Smoke to Climate Change. Their new book is The Big Myth, How American Business Taught Us to Loathe Government and Love the Free Market. Naomi, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you.
I gave a very nutshell version there. Can you tell us a little more about the concept of market fundamentalism that's central to your book?
Well, that was a great nutshell, and I think I could pick up with the word intervention. So you mentioned that. You asked listeners, do they believe in government intervention, or should we just let the market do its magic? But the whole notion of intervention is part of the big myth. It's based on the idea that there is something called the free market that exists unto itself, that has a kind of wisdom, and that we could simply trust it, that we can have faith in markets to do the right thing, and we don't need governments to guide the markets or set rules and regulations. And that idea is a myth, because the reality is markets are human institutions. They're created by people. They go back to time immemorial. There were markets in biblical times, and the Bible even has a discussion of certain rules and regulations for the marketplace. People have always structured markets in the ways they felt they needed to meet their needs and to prevent damage. But in the 20th century, we were persuaded to think otherwise, to think that there was such a thing as the free market that could exist on its own and that didn't need the government to set the rules of the road. And it's that myth that we challenge in our new book.
Yeah, that's the story you tell in the book, is not so much the idea itself of market fundamentalism, but how it was promoted to the point where it became, I guess, a given, almost taken for granted. What were some of the origins of this in ways a very successful public relations campaign?
Well, the book begins in the early 20th century with debates that took place over child labor and something that was known as the accident crisis. So many people have forgotten, or maybe never knew, that capitalism in the early 20th century was incredibly dangerous. One out of every 1,000 workers was killed or seriously injured on the job every year. And that was the equivalent of 1.5 million people today. So imagine if it would be like a pandemic, a COVID pandemic every year of workplace death. And so this led to a big discussion about whether government should play a role in regulating workplaces to make them safer, and especially why there were so many more deaths in the United States than there were in Germany and the United Kingdom, which were also heavily industrialized countries. And the answer people realized was workmen's compensation, that these other countries had insurance programs where the amount that an employer had to pay into the insurance's premium depended on how dangerous their workplace were. So programs of workmen's compensation not only protected workers and their families, but also created an incentive for owners, for managers to clean up their act. And so a big debate took place about whether or not the United States should do the same. Many reformers thought the answer was yes. Teddy Roosevelt thought the answer was yes. Andrew Carnegie thought the answer was yes. But a small group of business people began to create an argument, the argument that we trace in our book, that the answer was no, because if the government, quote, intervened, and that's the word they use, if the government intervened or interfered in the marketplace, it was a threat to freedom. And that's the story that we trace in the book all the way through Ronald Reagan, Bill Clinton, and to the present day.
Naomi Oreskes is with us. She's the co-author of the new book, The Big Myth, How American Business Taught Us to Loathe Government and Love the Free Market. And with those earliest stories, you start with child labor, workers' compensation, rural electrification. You see themes emerge that come up, as you say, to the present day. One of them that comes up a lot, and this was in the child labor debate, I think, was something along the lines of Soviet Russia, the communists are trying to do away with child labor. If we do that in America, it's one step toward communism.
Exactly. And this is a key part of the argument. It's red baiting. It's to say that anyone who points out any of the failures of capitalism, whether it's child labor, workplace injury, the failure of the electricity industry to supply consumers in rural areas, that anyone who points out these facts, these realities about the way capitalism is operating, get accused of being communist. And this, of course, is something that we see again to the present day. People who proposed, people who supported Medicare in the 1960s, people who supported Obamacare in the 2000s, people who support the expansion of Medicare today get accused of being socialists or communists. And this is a way of shutting down the discussion and making it seem as if the only choices we have are completely unregulated capitalism, capitalism run amok, or Soviet-style totalitarianism. And so a lot of the propaganda, the public relations that we document in the book set up this false dichotomy and make people think, or it's designed to make people think, that if you allow the government to address a problem like Medicare, for example, that you're on a slippery slope to Soviet-style communism, we lose all our freedom, and we're living in a new dark era.
A part of that outreach, and I thought this was interesting, targeted the education system at all levels. What were some of the earliest examples of, I guess, textbook wars over how we talk about the free market?
Yeah, and this is really interesting given what's going on in America today over textbooks. So one of the stories we tell in the book is about how the electricity industry tried to fight back against reform by distorting textbooks. So there was a group in the 1920s called the National Electric Light Association. This was a trade organization representing electrical utilities and the manufacturers of electrical equipment like Westinghouse. What critics pointed out was that the electricity industry had supplied electricity to urban consumers, people in places like St. Louis and Chicago, but had utterly failed to provide electricity to rural consumers. And this was a clear example of a failure, a market failure, a failure of supply and demand, because rural customers were demanding electricity. They wanted electricity, and many people thought they needed it even more, like farmers needed electricity even more than urbanites did, but they didn't have it. And they didn't have it because the industry refused to supply it because they didn't think that they could make enough profit. And so a group of reformers started arguing that the government should step in to remedy this market failure. In response, the industry launched a massive propaganda campaign. And it was propaganda. They were later investigated by the Federal Trade Commission, who called this the largest peacetime propaganda campaign in U.S. history. And the campaign was designed not just to persuade people that the electricity industry was great and we could trust them, but to change the way we thought about capitalism, to persuade us that any government action in the marketplace was a threat to freedom. And they did this by paying academics to rewrite textbooks, high school textbooks, college textbooks, to promote free enterprise capitalism, to promote an anti-government, pro-market ideology, and then pressuring publishers to adopt these new textbooks, sending free copies of the textbooks to thousands and thousands of libraries across the United States, supporting it with lecture series of paid basically shills who would shill for the industry, to persuade us that we just needed to trust the magic of the marketplace and everything would be fine.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Kurt is with us in Chippewa Falls. Kurt, hi.
Yes, I really empathize and sympathize with the point that the author, I guess, is making. And I would like to point out that this is by no means something that had merely gone on in the past or the previous century, but is going on today. In fact, there is a private college in Michigan that boasts about being totally free of government, any kind of government, federal government support or aid. And it is promoting a nationwide course called Constitution 101, which claims that the free market is embedded in our U.S. Constitution.
Kurt, thanks for that call. Naomi, that is a theme you bring in up your book, the idea that the free market is a fundamental part of American society.
Exactly. And I did not plant that call, but that was just a perfect call. Thank you so much for that, because that's exactly right. And that's part of the reason we wrote this book. This isn't just of historical interest. It's important because these arguments continue today, and they're being used even as we speak to justify rolling back protections for child labor, protections for workers, protections for unions. And I assume that the caller was referring to Hillsdale College. I get emails from Hillsdale College. They're very interesting. One of Ronald Reagan's most important speeches was a speech he gave at Hillsdale College, and we talk about that in the book.
Thanks for that call, Kurt. We're talking to Naomi Oreskes, professor of science history at Harvard University, co-author of the new book we're talking about. It's called The Big Myth: How American Business Taught Us to Loathe Government and Love the Free Market. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your reactions to what you've heard from our guests so far, how you think it does or doesn't fit the present day. Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Naomi Oreskes, professor of science history at Harvard University, co-author along with Eric Conway of the new book, The Big Myth: How American Business Taught Us to Loathe Government and Love the Free Market. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions for our guest, your thoughts on the balance between the government regulating business, banks, worker safety, and more. How much is too much? Call 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now. Elizabeth is with us in Eau Claire. Elizabeth, hi.
Hi there. Well, I appreciate the author's dichotomy word, because I totally agree there should be a balance. But I want to give two examples, an old one and a new one, of maybe where government does play a role in safety. One was the shirtwaist factory fire, which is in the early 1900s, when all these young women burned to death because the doors, the exit doors, were locked. They either burned or jumped out windows from the ninth floor, and I don't remember how many, but there were lots. And the other one would be more modern day, would be the Palestine train accident recently, I think in Kentucky.
In Ohio,
when the train engineers didn't have enough. They were too tired, often too long hours, and there were too many cars to this train and several other things I don't remember. So,
Elizabeth, I gotcha, referring there to the train derailment in Ohio. Thanks for the call, Elizabeth. Naomi, Elizabeth giving a couple cases where she thinks obviously some regulation might have helped.
Well, exactly. And one of the things we point out in the book, and we actually talk about the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory, because that was a very famous and important example that helped to support stronger workplace safety mechanisms. Almost all of the rules and regulations that conservatives, libertarians, and others have attacked in recent years were put in place in response to problems like the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory, to real problems in the way in which our economy was operating and the need for government to redress the balance. That the private sector had proven that you couldn't just trust them to regulate themselves. You couldn't trust businesses to create safe workplaces, that you needed government, you needed supervision, or another way of thinking of it is that the market needed rules of the road. So nobody objects to stop signs and red lights. Well, maybe some people do, but most of us recognize that stop signs and red lights and speed limits are necessary to keep us all safe and to enable us to drive on the road. Limited entrance ramps on freeways actually enable us to drive faster. So rules and regulations can actually be enabling. But in recent years, in the last 40 years or so, and you heard those clips at the beginning of Ronald Reagan and Bill Clinton, the dominant ideology has been one of saying that regulations are bad and that the government just needs to, quote, get out of the way. And that's just not true. History doesn't support that ideology. And so we wanted to explain, well, why do so many people, including both Democrats and Republicans, buy into this idea, which is clearly false, not supported by the facts of history? And the answer we show is, to a very great extent, a long, complicated, and well-funded propaganda campaign.
Thanks for that call, Elizabeth. Tom joins us now in Milwaukee. Tom, hello.
Hi. I have a recollection just from the last few months of someone saying that the story Little House on the Prairie, when it was depicted on the television series in different forms, that actually the daughter of the author rewrote those things and made it free market friendly to promote that subtly.
I believe, Tom, thanks for the call. I believe, Naomi, that is something you tackle in the book.
Yes, that is a chapter in our book. So one of the things we show in the book is how these ideas were propagandized in a wide variety of contexts, including textbooks, including film, television, radio, and children's books. And the most astonishing story is the story of the Little House on the Prairie books, which I and millions of other American girls grew up thinking were the true life stories of Laura Ingalls Wilder on the American frontier. They were marketed that way. They were pitched that way. But in fact, the books were actually written by her daughter, Rose Wilder Lane, who was a libertarian, an extreme libertarian ideologue, a friend of Herbert Hoover, a correspondent of J. Howard Pugh, the president of Sun Oil Corporation. Lane, Hoover, Pugh, and others worked to promote libertarian ideology in America. And one of the things they did, one of the things she did, was to rewrite her mother's stories as libertarian parables.
Tom, thanks a lot for that call. We're talking to Naomi Oreskes, co-author of the new book, The Big Myth, How American Business Taught Us to Loathe Government and Love the Free Market. I want to focus in on this particular marketplace, Naomi, the marketplace of ideas. And you look at the influence of business and money in promoting scholars and authors and others who promoted the ideas you're talking about. Could you talk about how that swayed the messages people might have heard?
Exactly. Well, the Little House story is the most heartbreaking, and the academic story is the most infuriating. So we like to believe, and certainly I, as a Harvard professor, would like to believe that academia is a kind of refuge where ideas win or lose based on the solidity of the ideas, the evidence behind them. But what we show in the book is that the marketplace of ideas was grossly distorted by a group of business leaders with links to the National Association of Manufacturers, a major trade organization, and the DuPont Corporation, who paid the University of Chicago to hire a key neoliberal thinker, Friedrich von Hayek, an Austrian economist, and to set up a project at the University of Chicago called the Free Market Project. And the specific point of this project was to develop a blueprint for a free market or free enterprise-based America. They paid academics to write books, to write articles supporting free market against the enforcement of antitrust litigation. And perhaps most egregiously, one of the members of this project, the economist George Stigler, published an edited version of Adam Smith, which grossly distorted Adam Smith's argument, stripping out all of the places in The Wealth of Nations where he argues for regulation, for the role of government, for the rights of workers, and gives us this very distorted view of Adam Smith. But it's the view of Adam Smith that many, perhaps most people in America hold today.
Your book covers a 100-year-plus history up to the present day. Naomi, what are you hoping people take from this book and do with it in 2023?
Well, the main thing I hope, I'm happy to say, is already happening, which is a conversation. What we really want is not to try to persuade people what the right balance between government and private enterprise is, but to have a conversation about what that balance should be, because we believe the balance is way off kilter in the United States, that we have excessively weakened the regulations that protect us as consumers, as workers, weakened the regulations that protect us against bank failure. We've seen that clearly this week. And that there is an important, essential role for government in protecting workers, protecting the environment, dealing with climate change. But we've been hamstrung in having that conversation. We've been hamstrung in using the powers that we have, even the laws that are on the books to address something like climate change, because of the dominance of free market ideology. And we think that if people come to understand that a lot of this was propaganda, a lot of this is not supported by the evidence of history, it will help us to have a better, more nuanced, and in the end of the day, well, a better conversation, and hopefully in the long run, more effective public policy.
Naomi, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you. It's been my pleasure.
Been talking to Naomi Oreskes, professor of science history at Harvard University, co-author of the book we've been talking about, The Big Myth, How American Business Taught Us to Loathe Government and Love the Free Market. Well, she ended with a kind of a question there. What is the right balance in any particular part of the U.S. economy versus leaving it to private enterprise versus government involvement? Love to hear your answers to that question. Maybe something that affects you in a part of your life or your work, or something you'd like to hear discussed more specifically, whether it's a healthcare policy, workplace safety, you name it. Let us know, and maybe we can tackle a future conversation about it. You could email us. You can do this anytime, but you can even email us right now, ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. Let us know your thoughts on the balance between a private enterprise and government regulation and what you want to hear more about. That's ideas@WPR.org. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network.